so this week is really, I think, more central than last week. As I said, last week was we were going to be smart with something small. This week, not so much. And this is, I call this year movies as Midrash. Moshe, the Prince of Egypt. Now, what is Midrash? Right? Now, Midrash is many different things. But what does it do? Right? What do Midrashim do? But they fill in the gaps, right? I put it here at number one, right? One of the main things, it does many things, but one of the main things it does is it fills in gaps, right? And I gave it to you in one, in an article by Dr. Moshe, Moshe Shoshan. All narrative texts have gaps or details of the story that are missing. A narrator must always choose which details to put into the story and which to leave out. This is especially true of biblical narratives, whose sparse style often leaves out information of interest to the reader, such as a character's motivation. I mean, the Bible, the Torah, leaves out many details in the stories, and not just details that are incidental, details that we need to know, we want to know, right, that are critical for us to understand the story. It leaves out character development. And Midrash tries to fill in those gaps, to give us the backstory, to give us the details, to understand the, to give us the full picture, right? Filling in these gaps is indeed essential to any successful reading of a story. The rabbis seek to provide us with as rich and detailed an image of the biblical events as characters as they can, right? That is one of the central goals of Midrash. And what I want to do, as I said, definitely today, possibly this week and next week, is focus on the largest gap that exists in the story, which is basically Moshe's life from when he is zero to when he is, well, there's two gaps. One is from when he's zero until when he appears again, right? From when he's picked up by the daughter of Paro, the daughter of Pharaoh, and he goes out to meet his brothers. And then the gap from that moment until he returns to Egypt when he is 80. Right? According to the Torah, he is 80. There's 80 years of which we know virtually nothing about, which, considering he is not just the protagonist of the Exodus story, he is the protagonist of the entire Torah from now, right? From when he is born until the end of the Torah. Right? The beginning of Shemot is his birth. The end of the Torah is his climactic death. Right, and no one will ever be like Moshe again, who spoke to God face to face, etc., etc. Right, he is the hero, and we know nothing. Right, we know nothing of what happens, basically, with the exception of one incident from when he was born until he was 80 years old. And the truth is, that's cheating, because there's even more we don't know, because we don't even remember this. But there's also a silence from the second year in the desert until the 40th. Right? After, right, all the drama happens in the second year, God decrees they're going to die, and then there's silence, and then we pick up in the 40th year. So the truth is, of Moshe's life, we know what happened at his birth, that one moment where he sort of appears on the scene, when he's 80 to about 82 and a half, 83, and then again when he's 120. That's it. Right? That is the entirety of his life that we know. And Midrash tries to fill this in. And here, I think the movies, more than in any other part of the story, are acting as Midrash. And are trying to fill in the gaps, but they're drawing on sources, right? They don't make it up. And to prove that, to start off really the day, this is, if you remember it, this is the prologue, right, to the Ten Commandments, which can say it as well as, well, as well as anybody can.
Just a fundamental way, I mean, it sort of bothers me that Dr. Shoshan is treating this as narrative, like as a story.
It is.
And Nebuah, rather than, I mean, there's obviously a reason the Torah was written the way it's written without emphasizing the character of Moshe.
Oh, so for that, that's definitely, right, that's one of the central questions, which is why, if these details are important, are they left out, right? That is, you know, sort of a bigger shear on Midrash, but it's, meaning it's undeniable, the Torah is also narrative, it's a story, right? And there's missing details of the story, and right, Chazal or the Midrashim clearly are trying to fill in the gaps. Right? I mean, if the Midrashim didn't even try, right? Then you would say, okay, this is just us, modern people. We like stories. We need details. But the truth is, but this is what commentary has done since the beginning of...
I think they're filling in the gaps to give us, you know, their perception of the character of Moshe. I think they're doing it to...
I'm not sure that's true. But look at the Midrashim. We're going to see. Because I don't think that's true. Meaning, homiletics as the, you know, it's just, they're giving a, right, they're just trying to inspire us. So giving lessons. I don't think that's what the Midrashim are trying to do. They're actually trying to figure out what happened. Because what happened is actually important. Right? That only begs the question, why does the Torah not tell it to us, which perhaps we'll be able to answer as we go along. But like I said, I'm happy to take this one for 2 weeks, because you're right. The question isn't just what happened in those years. If it is important what happened in those years, why does the Torah not tell us what happens in those years? But we'll try to, as much as we can, answer as many of those questions, or at least get a beginning of answers as we go along. But right, to sort of frame it, here, this is the prologue to the Ten Commandments.
Ladies and gentlemen, young and old, this may seem an unusual procedure, speaking to you before the picture begins, but we have an unusual subject, the story of the birth of freedom, the story of Moses. As many of you know, the Holy Bible omits some 30 years of Moses' life. From the time he was a three-month-old baby and was found in the bulrushes by Bethia, the daughter of Pharaoh, and adopted into the court of Egypt, until he learned that he was Hebrew and killed the Egyptian. To fill in those missing years, we turn to ancient historians such as Philo and Josephus. Philo wrote at the time that Jesus of Nazareth...
It's at the loudest, so...
And Josephus wrote some 50 years later and watched the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans. These historians had access to documents long since destroyed, or perhaps lost, like the Dead Sea Scrolls. The theme of this picture is whether men are to be ruled by God's law, or whether they are to be ruled by the whims of a dictator like Ramesses. Are men the property of the state, or are they freehold under God? This same battle continues throughout the world today. Our intention was not to create a story, but to be worthy of the divinely inspired story created 3,000 years ago. The five books of Moses. The story takes 3 hours and 39 minutes to unfold. There will be an intermission. Thank you for your attention.
Okay. I realize what it is. This is not actually plugged in, but I don't know how to do that.
Because this doesn't fit.
It's just coming from here because this is not. Anyone know where this is supposed to go in? Okay. I don't know. I don't know why this isn't working. Okay. I don't know. Anyways, well, we'll do what we can with it. What? I have no idea. He's the narrator in the Ten Commandments. I don't know. He's the narrator. He comes out before. Yeah. Yeah, you remember? This is before the Charlton Heston movie.
He wasn't the director or the producer.
He could be. I don't know. It doesn't seem like it. I don't know. I don't know. She just shows up. I don't know. Anyways, he's the narrator, right? This is... I don't know if anyone remembers this, but this is the beginning. It's before the music, right? This happens like before anything. He comes out. What does he tell you? Right? What does he say? Right? He says that I'm going to fiddle with this while I'm saying this. Right, what does he say? He says that there's a gap from when Moshe is 3 months old, right? From Moses is 3 months old until he comes out to his brothers. And the Torah is silent. So then they tell you that they actually engaged in Midrash. I mean, they did go. I mean, they did also go to Midrashim, but they went to Josephus, to Philo, to ancient historians to fill in the gaps in the story. I mean, that is Midrash. Now, coming back to Mars's question, now one of the things, one of the big questions that we always have to ask is, where does Midrash get its ideas from? And the answer isn't monolithic. Sometimes Midrash gets it from close readings of the text. Sometimes it's homiletics, right? It's not trying to give us history, it's just giving us a lesson based on the story. Sometimes Midrash has traditions, historical traditions that were passed down that are in the text but were assumed that you knew, in which case they are important to the story, right? They were just passed down with the text, right? Right, it's never quite clear which the Midrash is doing, but the Midrash, right, so sometimes it's actually filling in the gap, sometimes it isn't, right? It's just homiletics. But that's what Midrash is, right? Yeah, no, it's amazing that the movie starts with this introduction, admitting to you that what it's going to do is Midrash. And as it notes, the biggest gap, I mean, it focuses on one, but the truth is that there's really two, right? The biggest gap in Moshe's life, the two gaps in Moshe's life that we're going to focus on are from when he's 3 months old and taken by the daughter of Pharaoh, until we meet him again when he comes out to save the Jew who's being beaten by the Egyptian. And then two is from when he runs away to Midian from Egypt, and then shows up again when he's 80 in Egypt, right? Those are two huge gaps in Moshe's story. And I want to focus on two things. Right? I want to focus on two things. One is what happened, right? Simply, right? What was going on? What did he do for all this time? But then, what I think is the more important question, and this is, again, back to Morris's point, even if the stories are not telling you history, the bigger question that we have to ask is, who was Moshe when he saved the Jews? I mean, what was his identity? And who did he identify with? Right? Was he a Jew? Did he identify with the Jewish people, or was he an Egyptian prince who came around and heard God's message? Right, this is the question you've got to ask, and it's not quite clear, because if we try to imagine, right, here's the tension. Let me set up the textual tension, okay? Look at the sources. Two. Right, here's Moshe's beginning. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe in the Nile while her maidens walked along the Nile. She spied their basket among the reeds, we'll come back to that in a little bit, and sent her slave girl to fetch it. When she opened it, she saw that it was a child, a boy crying. She took pity on it and said, "This must be a Hebrew child." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get you a Hebrew nurse to suckle the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter answered, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will pay your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, who made him her son. She named him Moses, explaining, "I drew him out of the water." Okay? Famous part of the story. Now imagine, okay, he's 3 months old, and now the curtains close, and he reappears an adult. What does the beginning of his life look like? If you had to guess, what does his life look like? Like a prince. Does he know he's Jewish? No. I would have guessed not. Because he, right, is raised in the house of Pharaoh. What? In the princess's house. Right, he's nursed by his mother.
Wouldn't you think, my feeling was when I read that, if he's nursed by his mother, then he's living with his mother.
Well, so it sounds like actually she's coming to him, right? I mean, working for the princess. But the question, right, that you have to pose to you is, does even the daughter of Paro, the daughter of Pharaoh, or we'll call her Batya for now, right? That's the name that Midrash gives her based on a verse in Divrei Yomim in Chronicles, and that's what the movies all give her, so let's just assume that's her name, okay? Does she know who Moshe's mother is?
She doesn't care.
Well, I have a no and a yes. Okay, support no, support yes.
But she said she's taking her.
Well, no, sure. So she doesn't tell her that, right? She says, take this. She says, what? So she knows it's a Jew, but does she know that this is that this is Moshe's mother?
No.
So I have a no. Why no?
Because she didn't ask.
She didn't ask, right? And it sounds, so one way of reading the story, and the way I always read the story, honestly, and this still might, could be right, right? I'm not sure, is that, yeah, she had no idea. I mean, this is all serendipitous, right? Miriam goes and watches Moshe float down the river, and then she happens to end up in the palace, and then Miriam is very opportunistic. She runs in and she says, hey, I know a woman who's nursing. Do you need someone? And she says, hey, that's a great idea. She invites this slave woman to be the wet nurse, right? This was standard, right? That you would have a slave, a servant as the wet nurse, right? So to...
I'm looking for someone with the car number 533, Kia car, small car.
Anyone? Kia car 533?
Yeah, so you need to move your car because they are here to pick up garbage.
Okay. So one possibility, right, is that, right, this is all lucky for Yocheved, for Moshe's mother, that she gets to watch her own son, but nobody knows. Moshe doesn't know, Batya doesn't know, nobody knows. Right, I mean, she knows that he's a Jew, right? We got that. But Moshe doesn't know he's a Jew, right? And Batya has no idea who exactly the mother is, right? That's sort of the way I always read the story. And it makes sense, right? You want to hide as many details as you possibly can to integrate Moshe into the palace, save him, right? Get him out, right? That's the goal. Yeah?
And why would it specifically say that she called the mother?
No, so clearly Miriam calls the mother, but one way of reading this is Miriam calls her mother, but doesn't tell, right, the daughter of Pharaoh that it's the mother, right? She says, I know a wet nurse, right? And then she used the opportunity to reunite Moshe and his mother, but presumably, when's the last time then Yocheved probably sees her son?
Then, when she's finished.
Yeah, like 2 years old or whatever it was, right? That was about when people nursed until, right? There wasn't formula, there wasn't things like that. People nursed till about two, maybe a little bit longer. Right? In the Talmud, the standard was considered 2 months, 2 years, 24 months, right? And some people till 4 or 5, right? This was the culture, right? You didn't really have baby food, so, you know, people nursed for longer. That's one way of reading the story. Yeah?
Wasn't nursing him.
You're right. It could be. He's in Goshen. It's more like, my guess is that it's more likely she's in some sort of, royal accommodation.
But
right?
The point being that he would have been in a Jewish environment or milieu, say, if it's 2 years or 2.5 years.
Right, so for maybe two and a half years, right? But how much do you remember when you're a 2 year old, right? How many of you have memories or strong memories from when you're two?
It says grew up, doesn't say
weaned. Right, so but it probably it sounds like it means right, like enough to be finished nursing, something like that. You're right. I mean, there's all these ambiguities, right? And this is where I think the Midrash starts picking up, because one way of reading this whole story is that, you know, this is all a ruse, right? The daughter of Pharaoh doesn't really realize what's going on. She gets a wet nurse, and it's lucky. Moshe's mother gets her son for a little bit, but you know, by the time he's old enough to think and really understand what's going on, he's back in the palace, and that's it. Right? He's the Egyptian prince. That's one way. But there's another possibility here. And this comes to a subtlety, which was only pointed out to me last week, but the movies actually pick up on. Right, is where Right, we all imagine, or at least I imagine, I won't say anyone else imagined this, I imagine that where did Yocheved put Moshe? I imagine the scene. She takes her son and she puts him where? Puts him in a basket and then where?
In the Nile.
In the Nile, right? And then he floats down the Nile and he gets caught in the reeds. The problem is, right, the potential problem here is what happens if you put a basket in the Nile? Where does it go? Right, it goes, whatever, it goes downstream or wherever it goes. If something's in the reeds, how much does it move? It doesn't move. Also, Miriam, what does it say? Does it say Miriam followed Moshe?
Yes.
It doesn't say that. We all think it does. What does it say? Look, right, let's be careful. Right? She... sorry, okay, this actually, you need the verses before. Moshe has it, right? Where's Miriam? Right, or Maris, right? Where is Miriam?
She's stationed at a distance.
She's stationed at a distance, watching. What does that sound like?
To make sure he's okay.
Yeah, but what does it sound like that she's stationed?
So she must have put him in the reeds to begin with.
Yeah, it sounds like Yocheved put him in the reeds, meaning stationary, in the reeds, which means... He wouldn't move, which means she planned for Batya to come. Because presumably, the princess of Egypt doesn't bathe where everyone else does. So if you put him immobile in the reeds, and his sister is standing still watching him, that means that this is planned. And... Right, raise your hand if you think in the ancient Egypt, if you didn't know the king or the royal family, you would randomly walk up to the nation that was enslaving your people and say, "Hey, you just picked a baby out of the water," right? You hear her say, "Oh, and it's a Hebrew," or you say, "Should I get you a wet nurse?" Right? How many people would have been confident? What? Well, who else is throwing the kids into the right? So the movies say it's right. She's wrapped in right. She's wrapped in. He's wrapped in a Hebrew cloth. But right. If Miriam is stationary, right? She's standing there watching, and Moshe's in the bulrushes, meaning he's not moving. And it happens to be the princess is there. That's probably because that's where she normally went, which means that this was planned. And if it's planned, and Miriam is comfortable talking to. But Batya to the princess, that means she probably knew her. Which might lead one to believe that what is going on in this conversation, right? Not that Batya is blind and she says, "Let me get you a Hebrew," and she happens to get his mother, but it's hush, hush, wink, wink, right? "Should I get you a Hebrew woman to nurse the child?" And Batya says, "Sure," right? Knowing what's going on. So which story is it? Right? Does Batya know what's going on? Does Batya know who Moshe is? Who Moshe's mother is? Right? Which would go a long way in explaining. Right? Let's come just for a second to number three, the big question. Sometime after that, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his kinsfolk and witnessed their labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinsmen. And the big question everyone's got has to ask is, if he really is the prince of Egypt, then why does he identify with the Jews? How does he know that he is Jewish? Right? This is the question that you've got to ask in the story, which is, how do we get from him being the prince of Egypt to going out to the Jews and identifying with them? If the first version of our story is correct, namely, that Moses has no idea... Right. Batya has no idea who his family is. Moses has no idea that he's a Jew. He's just an Egyptian prince. How does he know that he is? Right? How does he know he's Jewish? If on the other hand, there's a bit of collusion going on, and Batya knows what's going on, everyone knows a little bit what's going on, then it might have slipped at some point. Right? You might find out. He might be living a double life. He might be an Egyptian prince, but... aware of the fact, possibly. Or his mother's aware of the fact. Now, you probably never thought of this question and watched the movie, and I didn't until I prepared this, but the movies take which position? Right? Not all of them, but Ten Commandments. Right? Ten Commandments, which one does it take? Here we go. Okay. Here, I think this is it. I think this is the right one.
Only the Pharaoh can free a slave.
Moses, do not enter. There is only sorrow here.
Right, what's happening in this scene? Right, this is the scene where, if you remember in the movie, Moses finds out that he's a Hebrew, right? How does it happen? So in the movie, right, I didn't put this scene, but what happens? The nurse for both Moses and for Nefertiti, right, was there with the daughter of Pharaoh, with Batya, when she took him out of the river, and she held on to the cloth that had wrapped him, which was the cloth of a Levite. Right, and then when Moses is poised to become king, to become Pharaoh, she said, "I owe allegiance to the pharaohs of Egypt. I'm not ready to see a Hebrew sit on the throne." Nefertiti kills her, right? Pushes her over the balcony, right? And then Moses comes in. Nefertiti is all right. She's frenzied. And Moses tries to calm her down, doesn't understand what's going on, and then sees the cloth on the floor. And Nefertiti tells Moses what happens, right? That she claimed you were a Hebrew. He says, "I'm going to ask, right, Bithy, I'm going to ask my adopted mother." She says, "It's not true, it's not true, it's not true." And then Moses says to her, "Is it not true?" There was a name, right? "Is it not true that I am the son of Joshebel, right, Yocheved, right?" And she says, "No, of course not, of course not." And then, as soon as he leaves the room, what happens? Batya gets in her chariot and runs ahead to Yocheved, which means that what does the movie think?
She knows.
Hint, hint, right? Hush, hush, wink, wink. Everybody knew what was going on, right? And Moshe, right, Moses, follows his adopted mother to his real mother's house.
"You're comforting it, my mother. Followed you here to find this woman, Yoshebet. You were the woman who was caught between the stones.
Until you came. My son, if you love me, you will..."
"I love you, my mother. But am I your son? Or yours?"
"No, you are not my son. If you believe that men and women are cattle to be driven under the lash, if you can bow before idols of stone and golden images of beasts, you are not my son. My son would be a slave. His hands would be gnarled and broken from the brick pits. His back scarred from the taskmaster's whip. But in his heart would burn the spirit of the living God."
"Does this God demand a scarred back and broken hands as the price of his favor?"
"This desert God is the hope of the hopeless. Your place is in the palace halls. You have mounted to the sun on golden wings. You belong to me, to Nefertiti, to Seti, to all those who love you."
"Do they love less who have no hope?" "Will you swear in the name of this God that you are not my mother?"
"We do not even know his name."
"Look into my eyes and tell me you are not my mother."
"Oh, Moses, Moses, I got it."
Right, so... Okay, so in this scene, right, what we first of all see is the movie takes the position, right, that at least Batya knew. Right, not just who, right, that he was Jewish, but who he was, who his mother was. Right now, it claims that Moshe had no idea, but it already opens the possibility that there is collusion going on. That it's not pure secrecy here. There are people who know. But it also opens the second question I want to deal with, right? And we're going to sort of go these in tandem, right? One is the historical question of what was going on. The second one, as I said, is the question of identity. Right? It's the question of identity, because this moment captures it very well, right? He says to his mother, his birth mother, he says to Yocheved, "Am I your son?" And she says, "No."
After looking at Batya.
But what does she say? Why isn't he her son? Because he doesn't act like it. Because?
It's a question of values.
It's a question of values. It's a question of religion. You bow to idols. You believe in slavery. There's two central questions. The Midrashim and the movies, right, are both dealing with. One is historically, simply what happened, the narrative. The second question is, who is Moshe during those years? Does he identify as an Egyptian, have an awakening? Or is he a Jew from birth? Not just genetically, but values, right? Is he a Jew in Pharaoh's palace, or is he an Egyptian prince in Pharaoh's palace who eventually becomes Jewish? Which is he? Who is his identity? Right? And the movie, right? What does the movie claim?
He's an Egyptian.
Right? His mother knows, but it's hidden from him. And his identity, until even after he goes out to his kinsfolk, right, even after he goes out to the Jews, is an Egyptian, just an Egyptian with a heart. But he's an Egyptian. Right? When he saves the slave, it's because, well, actually, no, we haven't gone to that yet. Right? But when he first saves the slaves, it's his mother. Right? He slaves her in the movie, right, from being crushed in the rocks. But when he actually saves the slave, who in the movie is Yoshua, which is a fascinating move in and of itself, right? It's Joshua. We'll leave that aside. Right? Then he already knows he's Jewish. Okay? But the movie says not only is he, right? The movie takes two sort of interesting narrative, interpretive stances. One is that Batya knows exactly what's going on. But two is that Moshe has no idea and is identity-wise totally Jewish totally Egyptian until the last moment, right? Until, well, here, until this moment, right? Those are the two, yeah.
His name is also important. Batya gave him the name, but from the Hebrew, Kimin Amai Meshitiu.
Right, so that's actually something fun. I didn't want to get into it, but since you bring it up, I'll bring it up. Right, the name is a problem, except, right, what does Moshe mean in Egyptian? And this is the kli, because Moshe actually has two meanings. It has two meanings, one in Hebrew, one in Egyptian. Right, what does Moshe mean in Egyptian? Right, this is quoted both by academics and by classical commentaries. The Netziv actually quotes this. Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Moses means son. As in, what?
What does it mean?
Son, child. As in, Ramses, son of Ra. Right? Ramses, Ramses, Moses. Right? Ra, Moses. Right? The son of Ra. Right? Moses just means son. The Torah isn't telling you why she named him. It's a midrash.
Hebrew.
Yeah, so it's not Hebrew. The Torah is giving you a midrash. In Egyptian, she named him Moses because he's her son. Just like Ramses is Ramoses, right, is the son of Ra. She just names him Moses, my son. The Torah is itself homileticizing Moshe's name for you and telling you in Hebrew this is what it means. The proof for that, by the way, this you have to understand the Hebrew. But Moshe, it's actually wrong. Right? Moshe doesn't mean min hamayim mishitiu. Doesn't mean I drew him out of the water. What does it mean? He draws out of the water. Right? It's an active word. Right? Because it's actually telling his future, not his past. Right? That he will draw the Jews out of the water in the splitting of the sea. Right? It's the Torah itself is being midrashic here. But probably the daughter of Pharaoh called him Moses in Egyptian, which means son. And that's what the Netziv says. That's not me, right? The Netziv says that his name was actually in Egyptian just son, right? Sonny boy, junior. Right? That's what it is, right? That's what Moses means. So these are the two questions, the movies and the Midrashim, in either direction, and to the extent that the movies build on the Midrashim, are trying to answer, is one, what happens? Who knows? Does he know? Does his adopted mother know? Do other people know? And two, how does he grow up? What's his identity? Is he an Egyptian? Is he Jewish? Is he both? Right? That's the question, the fundamental question everybody wants to know. The Midrashim play up on this no less than the movies. To give an example, okay? Let's continue here in 3. Okay? So the famous moment, right? He comes out a Jew. He turned his kinfolk away, and seeing no one about, he struck down the Egyptian, hid him in the sand. When Pharaoh learned of the matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh. He arrived in the land of Midian and sat down beside a well. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. But shepherds came and drove them off. Moses rose to their defense and he watered their flock. When they returned to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come back so soon today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Where is he then? Why did you leave this man? Ask him to break bread." Moses consented to stay with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah as wife. Okay, so we know the story. Moshe goes out, strikes down the Egyptian. Pharaoh chases him out. He goes to Midian. He saves the daughters of Yitro at the well. They leave him at the well. Yitro says, "What type of hospitality is that? Invite him for dinner," right? And then one thing leads to another, and he's married to the Yitro's daughter, right? That's the story, right? That's the story we know.
How old is he?
We don't know, right? So this is what we don't know. The Midrash in 4 gives 2 possibilities. They either say Moses was 20 years old at the time, and some say 40. Right? He's 20, 40, we don't really know. And what are they trying to explain? And that's number 5. The only age we know about Moshe is what happens when he's 3 months old, when he's taken by Batya. And the next time the Torah tells you how old he is in 5, is when he comes back to Pharaoh. Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron 83 when they made their demand on Pharaoh. So we have no idea, right? 3 months to 80, it could be anywhere. So the Midrash sort of guesses somewhere 20, 40, but that means he has at least 20 to 40 years growing up in the palace, and 40 to 60 years out of Egypt before he makes it back to Israel. Let's say to Egypt, right? Those are 2 huge gaps, right? And the shorter one gap is, the longer the other one is. But that's the question the Midrash is trying to answer. How old is he here? And what happens in this whole period? So we're going to go back and forth between the value question and between the value question and the historical question. But let's for a moment take the value question. Okay, let's start with the value question. Yeah.
He's behaving Jewishly. There's echoes of Rebecca at the well.
So one hand, he's definitely acting Jewishly. Right, he's kind. It's a classic Jewish scene. The well, right? The well. You meet your wife, right? This is like, you're right. He's definitely acting very Jewishly, but there's one word in it which implies that he is not so Jewish yet. One word: Egyptian. Egyptian, right? That even though you're right, he's acting Jewish. How do the daughters of Yitro perceive him? He's an Egyptian. And the Midrash picks up on this in 10. Skip to 10. Riblevi said, "Moshe said to God, 'Master of the universe, the bones of Joseph are entering the land, and I am not to enter the land.'" Right, so when you get, so the Midrash takes place at the end of the 40 years. They're going into Israel. Moshe is buried out of Israel, and Joseph is buried in Israel. Right? Joseph's bones are taken by the Jews, carried for 40 years, and they're buried in Israel. So Moses turns to God and says, why does Joseph get to be buried in Israel and I don't? The Holy One, blessed be He, answered him, "He who acknowledged his native land is to be buried in that land. But he who did not acknowledge his native land does not merit to be buried in his land." Whence do we know that Yosef acknowledged his native land? His mistress exclaimed of him, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew," etc. And he did not deny it, but in addition said, "For indeed I was stolen out of the land of the Hebrews." He is to be buried in his native land. Whence do we know this? For it is said, in the bones of Yosef, for the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, and buried in Shechem. But you, who did not acknowledge your native land, will not be buried in that land. When was this? When the daughters of Yitro said, an Egyptian delivered us from the land, from the hand of the shepherds, and Moshe heard and kept silent. Therefore, he is not to be buried in the land. Right, what is the Midrash picking up on? That as much as he's ethically like a Jew, right, he's the type of person you want to be a Jewish leader, identity-wise, right, value-wise, maybe he's Jewish just because he's a good person. Right? He has all the classic, but remember, and you picked up on a perfect scene. The scene at which we meet Rebecca, right? Is she Jewish yet, or just have Jewish values? She has Jewish values, that's why she gets chosen to enter the family of Avram. Right? That's where we meet Moshe. At a moment where he shows Jewish values, but culture-wise he's still an Egyptian. That's what the Midrash wants you to think. That's what the Midrash interprets this story. Right? This Midrash takes the opinion that identity-wise, who is Moshe? He's an Egyptian. He's an Egyptian, maybe with Jewish values, but he isn't yet part of the people. He doesn't yet feel that way. He isn't yet seen that way. And the Midrash, the truth is very harsh on Moshe for this. I mean, right, it's punishing him, right? It says you at that moment, but it's sort of unfair, right? Sort of unfair, right? He literally was the prince of Egypt, right? He was just the prince of Egypt. He didn't grow up amongst the Jews. But the Midrash is taking the claim that identity-wise, who is he? He is an Egyptian. And there's other evidence of this in the story. And it gets worse. Right, right. Moshe Lichtenstein, one of my teachers, pointed out that when he goes to Midian, what does he do first? Get married and then settle down, or settle down and then get married? Look at the end of 3. 21, the last verse in source 3. Moses consented to stay with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah's wife. Which came first?
Stayed.
Right, he stayed. Right? Where is the Midrash getting the idea that Moshe doesn't yet identify as Jewish? Because not only is he identified as Egyptian, but he agrees to stay in Midian before he has a reason to stay. Right? It's only after he settles down in Midian that Yitro says, "Hey, I have a shidduch for you, right? I have someone to set you up with. I have a match." But the psukim, the verses, almost make it sound right like he just—it's not just he's Egyptian and not Jewish. He's Egyptian. He's ready to immigrate into Midian. He hasn't been immersed in Jewish culture. He hasn't been part of the people. Either he doesn't really know, or he barely knows, or he knows, but it isn't who he is yet. Yeah.
But he has no choice but to stay in India. Where is he going to go? He is chased out of India.
Ah, for sure.
Pharaoh wants to kill him. He's in the middle of the desert, so...
Ah, perfect. So you could just say, well, he's in Midian, because what choice does he have?
Exactly.
And that might be true, but there's evidence that might also not be true. That he might actually be happy to be in Midian. Not just there because he has to be, but he's happy. What evidence would we have for that? So look at 8 and 9, right? Well, you know what? Let's look at 9 first. Moshe names his second son. And he names him Eliezer, meaning, the God of my fathers was my help, and he delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Right? How does he save him from the sword of Pharaoh? He puts him in Midian. Is there any longing there to go back anywhere? To go to his people? Right? He's happy that God saved him. He's happy where he is. He names his son, "You've saved me and put me here." You know, it's like God has helped me by saving me and giving me a life here in Midian. Right? He's sort of content with that. It's not just like he's saved. He's like, yeah, that's my life. God has saved me and let me live here. When does he sort of... And God needs to really sort of pull him out of it and say, right, in 8, at the burning bush, he says, "Come, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, and you shall free my people, the Israelites, from Egypt." But Moses says, "God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and free the Israelites from Egypt?" As we know, right, he protests, right, and the Midrashim take him to task. "Why are you protesting? Just go." But the answer might simply be, why is he protesting? Partially because he doesn't think he's worthy, but also, he's really an unnatural fit for this job, right? Because he didn't grow up amongst the Jews. He's not the logical person to lead them. Now, the truth is that the Ibn Ezra says no. The Ibn Ezra tells you, the Ibn Ezra asks the question, why did God arrange for Moses to grow up in the palace? The Ibn Ezra says, because a rabbi cannot be the rabbi in his own shul, right? Meaning the shul where he grew up, right? If you grow up somewhere, no one takes you seriously, right? You've got to come from the outside, right? You've got to come from the outside. Otherwise, people always view you as a child, right? So it could be that this is part of God's plan. He needed to be an outsider because it commands respect, right? You come with a mission, right? You were headhunted, right? By God. It's a good headhunt, right? You were headhunted from the outside, and God has to get him to buy into the task. He's not the natural Jewish leader. God says, "I see you could have the qualities," right? Coming back to the Rebecca example. "You're not yet Jewish, but I think you'd be really good." Right? You're really good for the job of matriarch. Right? So God says, "Look, I know you don't really, you haven't grown up with the Jews. You don't fully understand it, but you have the values down pat. You care about the downtrodden, you cared about the slaves. I'm going to take you." Right? But he's being headhunted by God. He's being convinced, "You're not the Egyptian anymore. You're going to go to Pharaoh. You're going to be the one." And Moses says, "Why me?" And it's a good question, right? Why me? If you want to see how harsh the Midrashim are, though, with Moshe, right? It's not just me who's being the middle harsh. The Midrashim are so harsh on him. Look at 11.
But before, there's also the names that he gave his children.
Yeah, Eliezer. So you're right. It's talking about God,
names
of, right? And Gershom, right? Which is right. I am a Ger, I'm a stranger, and I mean, he's lost, right? That's who he is. The Michilta in 11 is very harsh with Moshe and says as follows: "For when Moshe asked Yitro for Tzipora's hand in marriage, Yitro told him, 'Accept upon yourself that which I shall tell you, and I shall give her to you as a wife.' He said to him, 'What is it?' He answered, 'The first son you have will be for Avodah Zarah, will be an idol worshiper. From then on, for Hashem's name, I'll trade you. One son for idol worship, one son for God.' And he accepted it. Therefore, the heavenly angel came down to kill Moshe immediately." And that's how the Midrash explains why when Moshe is going back to Egypt, the angel tries to kill him. And Zipporah took a flint and cut the foreskin of her son, and the angel backed down. But the Midrash is willing to say about Moshe, not only is he Egyptian, not only is he Midianite, but even if he personally believes in God, he's willing to have one of his sons be an idol worshiper, meaning he's not yet, the Midrash is taking a very strong stance. Moshe is not yet identifying as Jewish. It's not where he is. Right? There's a process. And that's the process you don't really see. Right? What's going on in these 80 years? He is slowly transitioning, identity-wise, from being the prince of Egypt to being the savior of the Jewish people. And that's the story we don't hear about. Right, that's the story we don't hear about. But to be fair, it's a really important story. Right? And for the Midrash, this is haunts him for the rest of his life. This is why he never gets buried in Israel. Because right, he's criticized for not identifying as a Jew earlier. Yeah?
How
she knows about that? So that's sort of the flip question. Right? That's what the Midrash is sort of playing on. Is that he
converted?
Well, somewhere in the middle, right? So the movies make it that they actually all believe in God, right? The movies all like this idea that the Midianites are all from Avram, and therefore, they believe in monotheism. It's only, right, Moshe is taught by them, right? The movies like this. I don't know where they get this one from, but that's their answer to this question. You're right, it's unclear. You want another one. Here, this is from the Gods and Kings, okay? We're skipping a bit here. So here, What's happening in this scene, Moses, okay. Gods and Kings is a bit of a weird movie, okay? God is presented as a child named Malek, okay? Weird. We're going to leave that aside because besides for that, this is an important scene, okay? So Moshe here is being told about the death of the firstborn, right? So this is what happens.
You come.
He's given you what you asked.
No, it's a movie.
But his own people are turning against him.
And his army?
It will.
I disagree. Something worse has to happen.
I disagree.
You can't hear it?
Anything more?
You want to come closer to...
Would be what?
Here?
What were you about to say? Cruel? Inhumane?
It's not easy to see the people who I grew up with suffering.
Right, so just stop it there for a second, right? What is he... Right? It's not easy to see the people you grew up with suffering. And what does God respond to him? Leave aside the pagan imagery here, okay?
This much.
What about the people you didn't grow up with? What thought did you give to them?
Right? What about the people you didn't grow up with? What thought did you give to them?
You still don't think of them as yours, do you? As long as Ramesses has an army behind him, nothing will change.
Anything more is just revenge.
Revenge! After 400 years of brutal subjugation. These pharaohs who imagine they're living gods, they're nothing more than flesh and blood. I want to see them on their knees begging for it to stop!
It gets a bit weird. But those first, that like 10 seconds of dialogue is very powerful, right? What does he say? Right, Moses says to God, it's hard to see the people I grew up with suffering. And God says to him, what about the people you didn't grow up with? You still don't see them as yours, do you? Right? This movie, for all its problems, this scene is actually a perfect encapsulation of the Midrashic tension. What are all the Midrashim pointing to? That the story you don't hear about is the story of God making Moshe Jewish. Right? Making him, right? He headhunted him and convincing him to identify with the Jewish people. Yes, this movie says it's not until... Fine. This movie puts it all the way at the end. Right? That he doesn't really identify with Jews until the last minute. I would push it earlier. I would argue that it's earlier. But the sentiment is quite powerful. It's done well. Right, that this is the question that is going on in the story is when does Moshe hit that moment and stops being the prince of Egypt and start being the savior of the Jewish people, start identifying with the Jews, right? To the point where, right here, in this scene, right, God is convincing Moses, I have to punish the Egyptians for the Jews, right? They've been suffering. The Egyptians deserve it. Not in the movies. In the Torah itself, in the Psukim, we have the opposite scene, where God says to Moshe, after the golden calf, go down to your people, for they have sinned. Right? And the Midrash puts into Moshe's mouth, my people and not your people. Right? Right? But what is the Midrash playing on? Eventually Moshe is the opposite. Moshe is willing to stand up to God and say, you can't abandon them. Right? God says they're your people, not mine. Right? But Moshe, which means Moshe is totally identified with the Jewish people, even at his own expense, even against God. But when does this happen? Right? It's not natural. He grows up with the Egyptians. Right? This is the story, the untold story. And that's what? What?
Wasn't it in the burning bush that we go at first?
That's what he finds out, right? But that's what I think is fascinating here is you got to do two things. One is figure out not just when does he find out, but when does it sink in, right? And that's what the Midrashim are trying to ask, right? The Midrashim and the movies are asking two questions. What actually happens in these 80 years? And two, when does Moshe transform personality-wise to become Moshe, to become the leader of the Jewish people, most identified with the Jewish people? So far what we've done is we've analyzed one side of the equation, right? The possibility that Moshe, identity-wise, is Egyptian. And the story in the Torah is trying to make him Jewish, right? But let's see one more source for a second, right? If you look at 12, there are other midrashim that fill in other possibilities, right? This is Rashi when Moshe nursing from the Hebrew woman. So she expressly said, "Shall I call a nurse of the Hebrews, because she, Pharaoh's daughter, had handed him to many Egyptian women to suckle him, and he'd refused to take suck. This was because he was destined to hold converse with the Shekhinah." Right? There's another whole tradition in Midrash that says that from when he was a little boy, he was Jewish. He wouldn't even nurse from an Egyptian, right? It wasn't that this was the plan. It wasn't the plan that he was going to nurse from his mother. The plan was he was going to be Egyptian. Like, she took him and she tried to hire an Egyptian wet nurse, but Moshe wouldn't do it. Right? There's a whole nother midrashic tradition that no, he knew who he was from the moment he was born, and he was constantly countercultural. Right? He was countercultural in the palace. Right? But the midrashim are struggling with that same question. Right? Again, the two questions: the historical question, what happens, and the identity question. At what point, right, is Moshe always Jewish, just happens to be living amongst the pharaohs, or is he the prince of Egypt? And the story of the Exodus, as much as it's a story about the Jewish people, is the story of Moshe's progression, Moshe's development towards identifying with his people. Okay, so I thought this might happen. So, because I didn't want to, like I said, this I think is the most midrashic part of the movies, right? Because there is such a gap. Both a values, right, question, right? Who is he? Right? Who's identify with? And what is actually just going on? That's why, you know, this is, if you watch Gods and Kings, right, like I said, I don't particularly love the movie. It's a bit pagan, and the producer is anti-religious, and that's why you get sort of this weird vindictive god in the form of a child. Right, not exactly great, but what the movie does spend a lot of time on, the first hour and a quarter or something, is Moshe as Prince of Egypt. The Ten Commandments spends of the 3 hours also, an hour and a half probably, Moshe as the Prince of Egypt. And the Prince of Egypt, the movie, the cartoon one, right, which is, you know, meant for kids, so cannot be 2.5 or 3.5 hours, it's about an hour and a half, right? Still spends a bit of time on this. But the reason that both the Midrashim and the movies struggle so much is because these are the two big questions. Right, the two big questions with total gaps, total silence. Right, the most you have are these small textual cues, are these questions. And that's why I call this year, and again, we'll just take it till next week, movies as Midrash. Right? Last week we used the movies just as a sort of a jump off point to have a discussion about the Psukim. But here what we're seeing is what it means to write a modern Midrash. Right? The movies are no less than a modern Midrash. That's what they are. Right? Just like the Midrashim struggle, the movies are a struggle, and it's actually helpful to watch the movie and ask, what is it, right? What are the movie writers struggling with when they're producing it? What is it? What are the questions in the text that they're trying to answer? You saw it in the Ten Commandments. They were upfront about it, right? There was total transparency. That their goal was to fill in the gaps using Philo, using Josephus. And I've given you, in 14, Josephus for next week, where, right, we'll see. They actually take Josephus. They're not kidding, right? They take Josephus, and we'll see how they do it. So that's what we'll continue with next week. So I think the plan is next week we'll continue with this question, right? And then the last week we're going to get to, we'll do the purpose of the plagues, right? That'll be our last week, is what is the purpose of the plagues, and how does how do the movies portray the plagues? But we'll continue. I have another 3 or 4 clips to finish these sources. Maybe I'll bring some supplementary, but I think the clips and these sources will give us enough to discuss and imagine in these stories, but whatever, I'll decide before next week. Okay.